Michelle Beeksma is in our studio this morning. She has recently given a lecture down at the Depot and is an expert on the topic of the Treaty of 1854. She's the vice president of the St. Louis County Historical Society's Board of Governors. She's a member of the Society's American Indian Advisory Committee, and for the past 16 years, she has worked for the 1854 Treaty Authority. She's also a member of the Grand Portage Band of Chippewa. Good morning to you. It's great to have you here in our studio.
Well, thank you.
This is a 100. We were talking beforehand. Just look at the date 1854. It's amazing that a treaty from 1854 is still relevant. That's actually, I think, in many ways, good news. But this treaty has being still active is a topic of some conflict still to this day, 100 and nearly 70 years later.
Yeah, the whole issue of treaties in across the country really is. You know, they're government-to-government relationships, and they were made back when the federal government and the settlers were trying to, you know, settle the West. And most of the treaties had been made on the part of the federal government instigating them, wanting the land, wanting the resources. And I think we're all aware that maybe a lot of times the tribal people weren't treated fairly. You know, then most of that was a language barrier. They weren't necessarily. Sometimes I think there's a feeling out there that the tribal people were just that unintelligent or, you know, not world savvy. But these were very intelligent men. They were very good politicians. They understood, you know, in their culture, the importance of respect and process and. So it was really just the language and those interpreters that kind of bogged up the process where they didn't have a clear understanding of what they were signing. Mm.
But this treaty was different. This was instigated by the Chippewa themselves.
Yes, this one was different. They actually had a very good interpreter that they trusted. His name was Ben Armstrong. He's originally from Alabama and had moved up to Madeline Island. Madeline Island back in that time was kind of the seat of Ojibwe country.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Buffalo was there. There was lots of chiefs of the individual bands. He was kind of the overseeing chief of the of all the tribes. At the time, he's about 93 years old. And just prior to that, there had been a removal order signed by Zachary Taylor trying to remove the native peoples off the lands in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. They wanted to push them past the Mississippi.
Hmm.
So they attempted to do that by moving one of the annuity payments. Now, the annuity payments for the earlier treaties had always been made on Madeline Island, and that was always a big gathering place. In 1850, they moved it to Sandy Lake, Minnesota, and said you have to go over there if you want your payments for your money and your goods and from the other treaties. And they moved it to later in the year, so it was like October, November when they wanted them over there. I think the idea was if we can get them over there, then they have to winter over there, maybe they'll just stay there, or if they're already there, we can just kind of keep them there.
Hmm.
Of course, that was a difficult trip, and, you know, the weather is cold, and when they get there, the annuity payment isn't ready. They have very little provisions there. What provisions are there are spoiled. They had been wet and moldy. So even when they had to winter over there, they had poor quality food. A lot of people, there was a measles outbreak. They had to wait for the money to come. Eventually, the money doesn't even come, just the goods show up, which they pretty much have to sell off in order to make the journey home.
Huh.
Overall, going back to their lands in Wisconsin, they end up losing for about 400 people.
Wow. Okay.
So Chief Buffalo and the chiefs of the area, this is wrong. We're not going to let this happen again. So, like I said, he's 93 years old. He takes a few of his headmen and Ben Armstrong, and they set off. They're going to go out to Washington, D.C., talk to the president, who's Fillmore at the time, in a 24-foot canoe. Okay, and they paddle over to Buffalo, New York. At that point, they get on a train and make the rest of the journey to D.C.
Mm.
They don't get an audience with him right away. There's actually a New York congressman, his last name, George Briggs, I believe, finally gets them in to see the president. And they have a ceremony with the president. They have a pipe ceremony, and they discuss things. So what they tell the president they want is they want the annuity payments back at LaPointe on Madeline Island, and they want him to rescind the removal order so they can stay on their lands. And they want to make a treaty. And they want it in writing. So Fillmore agrees, and they go back, and then around about, they start in early August of 1854. Now, the treaty isn't signed until September 30th. So there's, you know, almost 2 months of negotiations going on. Because when the government officials get out there, the tribes have had a time to think about it, and now they want specific land set aside for them. So that was a big part of what the treaty did, was it set up the reservations, those plots of lands that were reserved for them, so that they would not have to leave their lands, and they had a place to live, then they would never be moved. The other thing that was a big part of it, and it's the part that's, you know, still going on today, is that they reserved the hunting, fishing, and gathering rights on those lands, so they could feed their people.
Right.
You know, those small plots of lands, you know, while they were, you know, adequate for living, weren't enough to feed everybody, and especially as you were, you know, hopefully our population would be growing.
Right. So to this day now, those hunting and fishing rights are still active according to the treaty.
Absolutely. And treaties are a government-to-government document.
Mm-hmm.
It would take an act of Congress to rescind those.
Mm.
And when we talk about those treaty rights that were reserved, it's kind of a fancy law term, usufructuary rights.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that, you know, if you sell a piece of land, you might retain the mineral rights on it, so if something valuable is found in the ground, or you might retain a right-of-way mm-hmm. on the piece mm-hmm. of land. So it's like, yes, I'm selling it, but that was part of it all along. You're retaining it. It isn't something that was given to us. It was something we retained. It always was ours.
So that you'd never actually surrendered, so to speak.
We never surrendered it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was, so for a while there was the thinking that this was like a special, you know, bonus right, something extra that we were given.
Hmm.
But this is just something that we retained. These are our lands that we had always been on. Right. Those were our traditional grounds, and we had always had those.
Now, this treaty, the lands, as far as the hunting and fishing rights, is it the entire state? So it's not just in the reservation boundaries according to our map nowadays.
Right. And if you look at Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, there is a treaty that covers every bit of that land, because at one point that was all territory. That was not United States land.
Mm-hmm,
so they
mm-hmm.
dealt with a local tribe and made a treaty.
Right.
When you're talking about, you know, if we just kind of focus on the 54 area, there is a boundary that it includes the reservations, but it's pretty much what you think of as the Arrowhead region.
Okay.
So we go down a little bit into Pine County. If you follow 53 north up to International Falls and then over to Grand Portage and the lake. So that was the land that was ceded in that territory, mm-hmm. and that was the land that we retained the hunting and fishing rights on. That was the land boundaries we were talking about in the treaty. So while you could live in those lands on the reservations, we still kept the hunting, fishing, and gathering rights off reservation within those boundaries. So each one's going to have a little bit of different rules.
Right.
But
so now, this treaty, of course, predating the founding of the state of Minnesota by the U.S. government.
Right.
Sort of setting up those boundaries. So this is this is before a lot of settlements occurred by European Americans.
Absolutely.
So what we're left with now, I mean, if you come to the modern day, because of towns and farms and fences and lands that are sort of considered in the modern day by a lot of people to be owned by them specifically, is that where the conflict comes in? Where is the hunting and fishing?
It's on public lands.
Public lands. Okay.
So county lands, federal lands, state lands, whatever's. So, yeah, if you have a piece of private property, we don't extend our rights and say we're going to go onto someone's property.
Okay. But now, because these rights are these rights let me back up. The sort of hunting and fishing rules set up by the Minnesota DNR, for example. You can start fishing on this date. You can start hunting deer on those dates. The ones that, you know, Minnesota state residents buy their deer hunting permits and so forth. Do the hunting and fishing rights for the Ojibwe bands in the state of Minnesota, do they, are they a broader set of dates? Are they a broader set of boundaries? How does that, how is that different, and where is that, where a conflict lies in these days?
Yeah, it's not uniform across the state, so it's going to be by treaty area. Mm-hmm. And so I work at the 1854 Treaty Authority. We administer the rights for Grand Portage and Boyce Fort right now. Initially, Fond du Lac had been part of that as well, and they do have 54 rights as well, but they are administering their own. Now, we do set our own seasons and dates and limits. We have biologists, and we have conservation officers. We have a code book. Our code and seasons and limits run very close to the state. With the 1854, we actually have another little unique portion. We made an agreement with the state to co-manage and to limit those rights.
It's fascinating to me that a treaty that's this old still has an active treaty authority working to make sure that those
to administer it. Yes,
it seems there probably are many, but it's sort of amazing to me that the current U.S. government is still working with a treaty that's this old. Because I feel like treaties supersede by other treaties and other agreements and changing boundaries and changing international relationships, but this treaty is still active all these years later.
Yeah,
is it becoming more difficult to defend the terms of the treaty? Is it sort of an ongoing same problem year after year? Are there some nuances that are now coming into play that you hadn't considered 50 years ago, 100 years ago, that now are being reexamined and trying to be redetermined by the groups involved?
Yeah, it has evolved, and it's way beyond the scope of what they would have thought of at treaty time. You know, they were just reserving those rights to go out and hunt and fish, mm-hmm. and feed their families. You know, these days we're very involved in resource management as part of that. You know, we do sturgeon studies. We led the way in wild rice management. You know, there's lots of committees. There's lots of... And we're working, you know, in conjunction with the state, mm-hmm. as well as the other tribes. We're, you know, we all work together to do the best thing for the resources. As far as, you know, you still get kind of that... kind of that pushback maybe sometimes about not understanding where the rights are coming from. Mm-hmm. Some people have the idea that we're just out there taking absolutely everything year round and there's no regulation on it and we're just sort of, you know, using up the resources. Especially in our area, that's very over-exaggerated just because of population-wise. Mm-hmm. We have a minimal impact on the resources compared to the non-native population, sports hunters, you know, there's just so many more of that, you know, of those type of people out there than tribal people. We just can't have that impact on it.
Well, it sounds to me too like there are a lot of committees in the treaty authority that are spending a lot of time on conservation, making sure that the resources are protected.
Absolutely, you know, and it's not just the you know, the wildlife management or the fisheries, but we have people working with invasive species and climate change and like the wild rice.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So we're involved in all aspects of it.
That's a whole other topic, I realize.
Right.
Wild rice is how the climate change is affecting the wild rice beds in the lakes.
You know, wild rice in its natural form is, you know, very sensitive to water temperature and water levels. And, you know, the big thing is talking sulfate levels these days with the mining in the area. That's a whole other can of worms right there.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, so this talk the other night at the depot, is this something that you do often? Do you give speeches on the 1854 treaty often? I mean,
we actually have a public outreach coordinator, and we're doing a lot of, we kind of hit a broad spectrum. We go out into the schools, and we actually have, we try to educate our tribal folks as well. So we talk about treaties, but we're also doing, like, outdoor education.
Yeah.
We're putting on a camp this summer, a week-long camp for, high school-age kids.
Uh-huh.
And trying to do some, there's a cultural aspect to it, but just kind of the natural resource aspect to it, kind of encouraging them to go into those kind of careers, getting some of our tribal kids involved in that area, so that they can be involved and keep this going.
I want to go back to one quick point. It was interesting you'd mentioned how the authority still works with the state, and I assume that means that, in this case, the state of Minnesota. The treaty was made with the U.S. government. At what point does it suddenly become a state matter instead of a U.S. matter? Do you sometimes have to deal directly?
Sometime in the, I'm going to say the 60s, 70s, there was kind of that transition period where the common thinking was, well, the treaty's old, it doesn't apply anymore, you haven't been using your rights. As the states made boundaries and they made their own rules, they tried to enforce those rules onto tribal members, and tribal people were like, no, we have a treaty, we don't need to, to the point where they were ticketing them and trying to hold them to state regulations. And that's kind of what precipitated the Minnesota agreement for the 1854, was that a tribal member had been ticketed. And then that was like the case that went through the court system. And the courts have always upheld treaty rights and the validity of treaties. And even though they weren't being used, that didn't mean you gave up those rights. Right.
Were these federal courts or state courts?
Federal courts.
Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Does Minnesota ever try to use its muscle saying that the state has more rights than the federal? That's again, another can of worms, because, of course, this treaty predates the state. So
absolutely. And that was the thing. And eventually we settled it out of court. And then that was kind of a binding agreement that was made.
Right. Well, we'll have links on our website to both the treaty itself and the treaty authority website, too, so people can get more information if they're curious about this. But it's
excellent.
Obviously a topic that's still very, very relevant
today.
Very
relevant, yes.
Yeah. And this is Michelle Beeksma we've been speaking with, and she's the vice president of the St. Louis County Historical Society's Board of Governors. She's also a member of the Society's American Indian Advisory Committee. She's worked for the 1854 Treaty Authority for 16 years, and she's a member of the Grand Portage Band. And so thank you so much for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yes, indeed.